If you're running a company, always employ people who know a heck of a lot more than you do. That way, the company moves forward.
Welcome to the OT podcast, which takes a deep dive into the topics affecting optometry today. Each time, we'll find a real expert in their field and attempt to pull everything we can out of their brain so it may reside in yours. This is the 9th episode in the series, and we're recording on the 6th of February, 2024. You can listen to the other episodes on the OT website, on Apple, Spotify, or from your usual podcast provider. In our 9th episode, we'll be speaking to Dame Mary Perkins, optometrist and co-founder of Specsavers, the well-known high street opticians, which was established in the UK in 1984 and has since grown to become the largest privately owned optical group, with practices in 11 other countries, including Ireland, the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Spain, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. On February the 14th, Dame Mary celebrated Specsavers' 40th anniversary. But first, let's introduce ourselves. My name's Kerry Smith-James. I'm the clinical multimedia editor for Optometry Today, and I'm also an IP optometrist in independent practice in Lancashire.
And I'm Ian Beasley, Head of Education for the AOP, Clinical Editor of Optometry Today, and a visiting lecturer at Aston University. Now, Kerry, before we welcome our guest today, I thought we'd take the opportunity to just have a sneaky look at the CPD that we've got on offer on the OT website at the moment. A couple of articles that have caught my eye, both from the Aston stable, as it happens. Firstly, there's an article by Dr. Jeremy Chang, where he takes a fairly detailed look at some of the emerging therapies that we have available for dry eye disease, those light-based therapies and thermal mechanical approaches for treating the condition. And then we also have a co-authored article by Danielle Beeson, Professor James Wilson, and Dr. Amy Shepherd that looks at assessing and managing digital eye strain in practice.
Jeremy Chang's article also caught my eye because we were lucky enough to go and film at Aston back in the autumn, and we did a CPD video on it. So anybody who did the dry eye video with Sonia Travicuate in the autumn might be quite interested in reading Jeremy's article, because it sort of builds on some of the equipment that we showed in the video. While we're on video, the next CPD video to come after Bruce Evans's Orthoptics is one by Jason Jedlicker. And we're going a bit niche this time. It's launching on the 9th of March, and it's about scleral lens fitting. In fact, it's four steps to improving scleral lens fitting efficiency. Now, Jason's lecture was first shown in the UK at the Hospital and Specialty Optometrist Conference back in the autumn. One of the attendees at the time described it as the best scleral fitting lecture she'd ever attended, and it certainly elevated my own scleral lens fitting skills in the editing process. So definitely worth a look.
Great. That's the CPD plug over and done with. So delighted to welcome our guest today, Dame Mary Perkins. Thank you for joining us. I'm sure you've got a very long to-do list, so thank you for taking some time out of your diary to tell us your story, really. When Kerry and I were prepping for this podcast, we've both been in the sector for several decades, and you know, we witnessed the meteoric rise of Specsavers, but I quickly realised I don't really know the story. I've kind of seen it happen. If it's okay with you, can we rewind to the beginning? I've got so many questions to ask, but really the beginning is perhaps a good place to start. And how did you start out with Specsavers?
Thank you, Ian. I'd be delighted to tell you. In fact, we probably should write a book. And a lot of people listening in now probably don't know what optics was like back in, we're talking about February 1984. It's quite a long time. Oh, 40 years ago, isn't it? So 40 years that we're talking about. And I was on a bit of a career break. I wasn't physically working as an optometrist then. I was working with a charity organisation called Citizens Advice Bureau, which was very interesting. Still meeting people, being able to talk to people, which was very good. But along comes Margaret Thatcher, and she was going to change all the rules for professions on advertising and whether you could actually use people in the business that weren't fully qualified. So we're talking now optical assistants, you know, they got the experience, but not the university degree, so to speak. And she wanted it all changed, but not just for optics, mind. She was looking at accountants, lawyers, anything like that, the professions, as she would say. She said, we weren't open enough about what we were doing. We weren't open enough about prices. People didn't know what to expect. And I thought, well, you know, she's right. And because of these changes, in was sneaking. We had the very first what was called lens crafters popped in from America then and opened up in London. Thought, oh, wow, hang on a minute. That spurred us on to thinking, yeah, let's go back into optics. This is something that we can do here. Glasses were very expensive. Opticians, believe it or not, didn't put prices on anything in those days. When they did the prices, they said, oh, your left lens costs this, your right lens costs this. There's an extra charge here for a bit of metal glazing. And it went on like this until the bill came in and I'll call them customer for a moment. I know they're patients, customers. We can interchange them. The customer would sit there and think, oh, my goodness, I didn't know that's what I was going to pay. That's not right. So we thought, right, we come in and we let people know that it was affordable because people weren't going that often to see an optometrist for their eye care, which, again, was not a good thing. Never mind about buying something. They just weren't keeping up with the eye care side. So we thought, right, we'll call it, after a lot of thought, Specsavers. So that's how it started. So through Margaret Thatcher, really, altering those laws and those rules and standing up there and sort of with her handbag thumping around like she used to and say, this has got to change. And we were the first people to do any advertising. And I did go out and about to different exhibitions, nothing to do with optics. I'm thinking of one in Bristol called Woman's World, where I put up a stand with glasses and spoke to people and handed out leaflets and told them about Specsavers, the very first store. That's the very beginning. And it was really making it affordable for everyone. I mean, there was National Health then still, of course, on glasses, but it was making it affordable so that people came on a regular basis for their eye care, basically. And making the pricing easier because, as I say, there was all this bits added on. So coming up with a complete price and being very clear what you would add on if it was bifocals or multifocals or whatever. And that's when we even introduced the two-for-one. So that people had another pair.
And so you had to start somewhere. So you opened that first practice. But did you see at that time the ambition to spread those practices across the UK and beyond? Or did it just kind of get out of hand a little bit?
That sounds quite funny when you say it like that. No, obviously we were going. I'm including my husband in this because Douglas is also an optometrist. But we did intend to sort of spread right across the UK. And we thought, well, maybe 100 practices might be a good number. For the simple reason, if you're advertising, it's very expensive for one or two or even three stores to advertise, say, on TV or a newspaper or a magazine, whatever. You've got to be able to spread that advertising because the newspaper would go for such a wide area and they're not going to people are not going to travel 20 miles or whatever to go and see an optometrist. So that was the reason for expanding. But in the first year, we were very careful because we had 5 stores in the first year and we wanted to make sure that it worked, doing the complete price, telling people what the prices were, and a lower price than what might have been charged generally, not low price, but an affordable price. And we wanted to make sure that the whole thing brought in extra people. It had to stand as a business. For that first year, we were very careful on the figures to be able to produce that, to show people that it actually worked very well, what we were doing.
And you say you started out with 5, but that's quite a lot, isn't it, really, within a year, when I think of the independent practice that I used to work for, it took us many years to get to what's only 5 practices now. And when I think of the amount of work it takes, so was it the partnership model that helped facilitate that growth, would you say? Or
definitely. I'm glad you brought in about the partnership model because to me, that's what it's all about. But as I was pointed out just now, the first year we had to make sure the figures were right before we could say to partners, you know, do have a partnership in this in this practice, this is going to work, because you have to show them that it is working. And then it was joint venture partnerships right throughout the country. And as I said, we thought 100 might do the trick. It might be fine. It did become quite apparent that people, they want convenience. Mm. I think we're all like that as far as, let's call it shopping, where you go somewhere, you don't want to have to travel for miles, find somewhere to park and, you know, take a whole day on the thing. People want convenience. So it became very apparent that we could open a lot more. And also there were people wanting to join as well as partners. So I was going to say that took us by surprise. It did really, because we only planned out for this hundreds spreading out, you know, and it certainly has changed as the years have gone on, yes.
Just remind the listeners how many practices you have now in the UK.
We're just coming up to the number 1,000. That's quite a lot, isn't it? But you've got to remember, some of our practices now are inside Sainsbury's, in shopping centres, things like that, that it's a matter of making it easy for people. Let's take the barriers away, so to speak.
Something when I was in practice, as I say, in independent practice, we were always slightly fearful that a Specsavers was going to open, you know, in our town, and what would that do to our business? And of course it happened. And what surprised me is when Specsavers did open in our town, we immediately got busier. I don't know whether that's something that you've witnessed in other areas.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I think that's how it should be. Number one, people should have choice. You're quite right. Once you start, you open a store, you make a big fuss about it, it makes people think, oh, eyes. Oh, yes. So everyone really does become that little bit busier. And that's fine. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, that is a really good thing to happen.
I'm just quite interested in, I mean, you mentioned Doug. We haven't really brought him into the conversation. It's all about Mary today. I mean, you must have been phenomenally busy, even just with the 5 practices before you started on 100. But, I mean, how did you divide up the work? Were you both testing? Were you both working on the business rather than in?
Yes, I can tell you now the testing side went down a bit. And, you know, I'm thinking now, 40 years later, I still miss that. It's funny, don't forget, being an optometrist before 15 years, lots of eyes to see there in 15 years, and it becomes part of you. You do miss that. But a lot of the stuff, thinking of Doug now, he might be looking at leases, the property, getting eventually after that first year, getting the partners, interviewing them and explaining everything and all sorts of things like that, whereas I would be maybe helping train the people in the store, or some of the optical assistants maybe, or whatever it happened to be, merchandising. I used to go and put the frames up how we wanted them. This is initial days, very early days. And I used to take a couple of people with me supporting, and we had T-shirts, MMM, Mayor's Mobile Merchandisers. I don't do that anymore. those days. I wish I'd kept the T-shirt. And also, I did a lot of the buying of the frames. So it meant going out Mido. I love Mido and Silmo. Any optical exhibition to see direct to the manufacturers. We weren't at that stage buying through wholesalers and such, but direct with the actual factories, so to speak. That was great fun. I enjoyed that.
If we fast forward now, how does a typical day look for you now? So 4 decades on, what do you spend your time doing within the business? Or have you got an opportunity to step away from the business a bit more now?
Well, you're quite right, Ian. Maybe I should step away. But no, if you enjoy doing something, you've got a passion for something, yes, you keep at it. But I've always had a theory, and I'd say this to anybody listening, if you're running a company, always employ people who know a heck of a lot more than you do. That way, the company moves forward. Initially, we were doing our own marketing. No. Later on, you have a marketing director and all these marketeers, they know exactly what they're doing, things like that. You always, you know, use that knowledge and move a company forward. So now I don't actually have a job title anymore. So most people laugh about that. But I'm here every day not always in the office. I could be out visiting a practice, going to some of our regional meetings, some all sorts of things like that. So I'm not always stuck in a big office here. But I do a lot. It's really looking after your people. finding out, how can I give you, I'll give you some examples that you can always improve on looking after your people. I'm the person who writes birthday cards, condolence cards. I've just written one today, actually, to somebody whose father's died. Babies, birth cards. I've just done a girl and a boy today with a present. That's gone off. We do congratulations, get well, retirement cards, and we on long service, which is congratulations. People, I did one this morning. Somebody who'd been in one of our stores, a partner there, an optometrist for 30 years. So I went, I'd done a card and a present for him, but I made a point of going on a screen. We live on these screens nowadays with little faces on them, don't we? And having a good chat with him about how things were going and things like that. So a very varied, but I've got all the nice things to do, haven't I? Those are nice things to do. But I'm kept fairly busy. One day I'm sure I won't go to the office. But I somebody did ask me, same as you've done, it's why I do it every day. It's everybody's so much younger than me, and it's much more fun then when they're younger. And listening to what they say and how they work and how their lives, it gives some variety. It's better than doing a hobby at home or something.
And coming up to the 40th anniversary, is there anyone that you're aware of in the business that has been, is still there after the 40 years?
Yes, there is. One of our optometrists was our first optometrist straight off his pre-register in the Bristol practice. Somebody who helped a lot of sort of background stuff, and she's still with us, so she would have been 40 years. There's quite a few at 35, but those are the two main ones at day one.
How did you celebrate the 40th anniversary?
We celebrated by linking up with all our support offices, because there's 2,000 people supporting those 1,000 stores. We celebrated mainly in my office where I am with cutting a big cake. And it was four tiers, four levels, and all usual suspect savers stuff all over it. And then, of course, our national seminar, which is coming up about the second week in March, that we will be having big celebrations then. Yeah, it's great fun.
So reaching that 40th anniversary milestone, how did that make you feel?
I'm very proud of what, it's not just me saying what I've achieved, it's thinking about all the partners that we have in the stores and their teams. They work so hard, and they have the customer right at the centre of what they're doing. So you cannot run retail optics sitting behind a desk, in my opinion. You have to be out there listening to the customer. In our case, we listen to what the partners say, listen to their teams. It's getting that feedback. You have to be at the sharp end and know exactly what people want. It is the partnership and hard work by a lot of people who have the same passion as me. You know, we're there for everyone. Affordable eye care for everyone, basically, is what I say to them. And I really do mean everyone. Rich, poor, young, old, anybody. So no niche stuff there at all. And I'm so proud of them all. Really, really am. It's like a big family. We call it the Specsavers family. I tell them that, well, we all laugh when we say we got green blood. So we do have a laugh about that. And I know that they're making a difference every day. And that's the other thing I like to tell them. And in fact, when I come into the office, I say to people, right, making a difference. I think it's MAD. I said, right, are you going to be mad today? But it is about making a difference. It doesn't matter who you are, really. That's what you need to do.
Just picking up on that point of making a difference, okay, and what you look to offer. At the outset, you were looking to, or you started out by looking to deliver value to patients. And maybe that story's changed a bit over the years now. And do you now see your role as not just delivering value to patients, but delivering more accessible services? So there seems to have been sort of a change in the ethos, if that's the right word, of moving away from the two-for-one drum being banged so much and more about eye care.
We've gone through stages in optics, haven't we? We sort of had the eye care thing, glasses expensive, then comes in the retail, let's call it retail, because it didn't, years ago when we started, there were not showrooms where you could just walk in and try on glasses. They didn't exist. So So we've gone through the retail stage, which is fine, but we really need, and it's important, and people want it anyway, is the eye care side, the actual health of the eyes. And you must have read so many things of recent times that people need that convenience. They don't want to wait. You go to the doctor, poor doctor has had to do the whole body, if they can get an appointment with the doctor, that is. So they need to know about their eyes quickly and sensibly with an optometrist. And that's where the eye health side comes in, and whether we can help on certain aspects without them traipsing for hours off to a hospital and sitting in a big waiting room, clogging up the system, basically, where the hospitals need to deal with something that's, I was going to say complicated, but, you know, there's something more serious. They don't need the minor eye conditions and the aftercare of glaucoma and cataracts, etc. They don't need to do that. And it's, there's so much that the optometrists, whether they're in a house practice or in a high street, can do. And they're nowadays, they're well trained to do that. And with the extra certificates that they're all showing me when they've got these diplomas and all the different care that they're doing, they're quite more than capable. So that's, to my mind, that is the way that we're pushing. I say pushing, you don't have to push very hard, but that's the way that things are going, and quite rightly. And there's a lot of common sense in that as well.
Do you mind if I just go back to something that you said right at the beginning? I just wanted to unpick something a little bit. But you said you were working for Citizens Advice Bureau.
Yes, yes.
And then you decided to go back into optics. Why did you leave optics to go into Citizens Advice? Is there a story there that you'd like to share?
It's a long story here, but I'll cut it short. Both myself and Douglas did our pre-reg year, and immediately we were independent optometrists. And we worked in Bristol, because that was my hometown. So I dragged my Welsh husband along with me into Bristol and had what you will call an independent practice, which we then opened other stores and employed ophthalmic opticians, they were called. Nobody could spell ophthalmic, of course. It wasn't long after that they adopted the American word optometrist, but ophthalmic optician, that's what we were called. And we grew that to a small group, 20, 21 shops. They were shops, not shop fronts like you have now, no frames in the window or anything like that. It was sort of fairly closed up, really. And we sold those to a big pharmaceutical company called Sanger's. So this is, we're talking 1980 now, who were going to expand throughout the UK. I have to say, I stayed on with Sanger's for a bit to help them understand the optics, because they weren't really know what they were doing. And they just gave up. I think they felt it was too complicated. And they said that they sold 6 months later the whole lot to Donald and Acheson. So that was the gap. So 1980 sold. And part of the selling of the contract was that we weren't allowed to open again or in competition, I suppose, for 3 years. So we sort of ummed and ahed. And my parents were living in Guernsey, the Channel Islands, and they were getting elderly. And we thought, well, okay, we can't work in optics in Bristol, where we were. So let's move to be near my parents and decide what we're going to do. And half thought that we might go and work in America. And I know you've got to get you've got to do an exam. You don't just walk in and say, I'm an optometrist. Hi, here I am. But we did meet a very nice optometrist on holiday there, and he wanted us to take over his practice. And so we ummed and ahed. And then, of course, along comes Margaret Thatcher, and thought, hey, this is good. We don't need to go to America. We can actually decide what to do, and came up with the joint venture partnership. I never did go to America.
Can we come on to some of your personal successes? You were made a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about and how it felt? How did you find out?
Yes, felt very strange. When you first open a letter and you see it, you can't quite... You look at it and you think, oh, it says OBE, maybe. And you say, no, that's a D. And anyway... It would have, of course, don't forget, I do live in Guernsey, and the Channel Islands are allowed every now and again, there's a panel of people that sit and decide what they're going to do, and it's sent off to the UK where it's considered. And I think it's quite a big business here at Specsavers in Guernsey, as well as other places, plus a lot of charity work that I've been doing for quite some time. And I think that's how it came about. I mean, I'm not privy to how it all happened, but nevertheless, it sort of did take me back a little bit. And I remember asking my family to, after this, I thought, well, I'd better tell the family before it gets out into the news, because obviously newspapers pick these things up, don't they? So I called them in. I said, I've got something to tell you. And they all came to my house looking very worried, because they thought I was going to say something like, oh, I'm terminally ill, and I'm whatever, or I'm leaving your father, or whatever. They were really worried, and I had to put them straight out about it. I said, no, don't be so worried. What I've got to tell you is really good. So that sort of changed everything there, to accept something like that. But it was for business and charity work.
So that brings us really quite nicely to talking about some of your charity work. Can you tell us a little bit about it? And obviously you started at Citizens Advice, which, as you describe, as a charity. I hadn't realised...
I don't do that now. Yeah. No, I don't do that now. All I do for Citizens Advice now is pay for their Christmas, for all the volunteers to have their Christmas lunch, because that's great fun. Oh. There's so many, I don't really know almost where to start. So I'll start about some of the things I've been thinking of recently. Is I'm very close to the Gurkhas Welfare Trust, which is looking after old Gurkhas, basically, and their families, particularly in, obviously, the UK, yes, but Nepal. And we've set up medical camps, quite remote areas there, where eyes and ears are done, apart from anything else, but eyes and ears, which is obviously my interest. So making sure that those work. And I have been out to Nepal and visited some of the villages there and some of the medical places. I'm an officer of the Order of St. John's. That sounds good, doesn't it? I don't know if anyone knows the London area. There's St. John's Gate and the Priory of St. John's there that deal with all St. John's ambulances and the St. John's cadets. And so I involve myself with the cadets programme and speak to cadets there. And I like that, because what they're doing now is some of the cadets are taking youngsters off the street, more or less, that probably were not being as well behaved as they should be, and teaching them the first aid side as cadets, giving them a uniform, and it's transformed them. I speak to quite a lot of them. All of a sudden, they think, oh, right, I'm somebody, I've got some purpose, I'm somebody important, I've got a uniform, I'm learning first aid. And they were very knowledgeable, and I thought it was good to see young people coming on like that. So there's a long list of things that I get involved with. Lots to do with women. Age Concern is Age UK in the UK now, but in Guernsey, where I live, it's still called Age Concern, the old word. So I'm quite involved with, there's lots of things for older people who sometimes are younger than me. But anyway, never mind about that. That's quite fun. The Macula Society. I love to sort of join in with both in the UK. And again, Guernsey's got a very strong Macula Society club here. They are very, very supportive, very supportive. So it's things like that. I'm not a sporty person, but I get involved in a lot of sport where I live. You won't know this, and now neither will anybody else, so I have to explain it. Around the world, there's an organised, and you get Commonwealth Games. You all know about Commonwealth Games, don't you? There's also called the Island Games, International Island Games, which is a group of, can be up to 37 islands around the world, not big ones, so we're not talking Australia, small islands, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Menorca, places like that. Every 2 years, there's Island Games, which I get involved with. It's held on a different island. Well, in 2022, Guernsey held it, and the whole place comes to a standstill for a week. If you've got 3,000 athletes flying in from all over the world, and all 14 sports are all to be organised, and there's an opening ceremony, closing ceremony. So that was my job. With a very good committee, I hasten to say. So, as I say, I'm not a sporty person, but I do get involved with a lot of organisation of sport, because in my opinion, and I see it in young people, we have things like Specsavers Youth Games and things like that, and support young people playing football in football teams in the UK and things like that. It's really good health-wise, mental, physical health is get out, do some sport, make friends, make new friends, learn how to behave, all the rest of it. So I'm very much behind all that. It goes from young people up to old people. And I'm not going to go through a whole list. It would go on too long. But it's all fun.
And Mary, just going back to the business side of things again for a moment. So you set out with that sort of conservative ambition, in inverted commas, of perhaps having 100 practices across the UK, and then that's obviously surpassed that many times over and gone to other countries as well. And have you had very much involvement with that expansion?
I did at first, not now. Not now. I mean, the first country, forgetting Republic of Ireland, the first country we went into was Netherlands, which was, we're talking about 1990, some time ago now anyway, quite some time ago. A little bit strange because I'm not sure that we did thorough research on it, but it seemed, I don't know if you've ever been to the Netherlands, it feels almost like being in the UK, and I've never known so many people speak fantastic English. Their English is better than our English sometimes. So I thought, oh, this is not a bad place to go. And I can tell you a funny story with going into the Netherlands, but we had a marketing director at the time. He got some research company in, consultants. Always go on your gut feeling. So I'm telling everybody listening, if you know something is right and you've done your own homework on it, do it. Never mind about what consultants say. They said, oh, you can't use the name Specsavers. So why not? Spec in Dutch means bacon. So that would be bacon. So they would just laugh. You can't use Specsavers. So I said, all right. He said, well, we'll come up with a new name, which they obviously charged for. Yeah, sorry, consultants who are listening, but there we are. They said, oh, no, OptiPrima. Okay, OptiPrima. So the very first store we opened in the Netherlands was called OptiPrima. I've still got photographs, and I've got a picture of me cutting a cake and being all the rest of it. Then talking to people, this is a customer, patient, whatever you want to call them, well, because we had Specsavers are on the cases, Specsavers are on the spectacle frames. Why are you calling it OptiPrima? Why don't you call it Specsavers like in England? And I said, well, we were told that that was not a good word. No, we watch your TV. We've seen your adverts. We know what Specsavers is about. And I said, well, it means bacon. They said, ah, we know what specs means. Specs is glasses. Specs. So within about a month, I had down the signage, it was still the same logo, taken off, Specsavers up there, and we went, any stores opened after that were called Specsavers. So that was a bit of a long story, but that was the first country. After that, we've looked for places where you get the qualified optometrist, been to university, same as we would have in the UK. It's I'm not looking for optical shops. We want the eye care side as well as your contact lenses, your glasses, whatever. We wanted the eye care side. So we didn't want just to go somewhere where people would go to the ophthalmologist, get a prescription, and then go into an optician shop, let's call it, just buy the glasses. So we only looked at places where that qualification was there, really. But what I'm trying to say is they've got the same qualifications as we would have in the UK. And I'm happier with that model, really, much happier with that. Hence the reason for going to Australia and New Zealand and now Canada. We're still expanding a lot in Canada. That's a big country too. I love Canada. I did quite a lot of research out there. Going back about 8 years, but I must have had my eyes tested in different optical outlets, about 50 times at least. They didn't know who I was. I was just seeing how the system works, because it's quite different there with the optometrist. The doctor is sort of separate, but not separate in a way. It's got, you know, they've got their own door, so to speak. Yeah. So it's quite interesting.
Although the system might be different, do you see when you go into those different countries that the proposition to the customer or patient is pretty much the same as the UK? It's about
yes.
that.
Very much. You're quite right. Very much the same. We wouldn't go into a country where you've got to be able to make a difference. You've got to be differentiated. It's no point doing a me copy thing. You've got to be different for to attract people. And certainly in Australia and Canada, two that are more recent in my mind rather than the Nordic regions, it has proven that that's what people liked. And listening again to them, it was fine. And the partners that we have in those countries are fine. We learn from them again in different places. It's I don't visit those countries as often as I would like. It'd be December this year before I get down to Australia.
And then just coming back closer to home again, Specsavers it's not just about eye care. You know, you moved into hearing care. I don't know when that happened, but was that just in your mind, just a logical expansion of services for patients? So same value proposition?
Yeah, exactly that. It's helping them and it's making a difference. And, you know, we have, and I think of some of the other things that we do is also we're there for everyone, knowing what they want. More recently, people will have realised that we're doing a lot of home visits. So we have a whole team of people. So again, special partners, they might be linked to a store, but they're never in the store. They're actually completely looking at home visits and helping those people, because there really are a lot of health, eye care things that need doing for people who cannot get out to go to a normal high street opticians, basically. So there's a lot going on there. And, you know, I started my life as an optometrist, ophthalmic optician, doing a lot of home visits when I first started. I loved it. Meeting the different people. And I think you've got to be a special optometrist to do that. And you're going to be, and first thing you do is get in your car and set up all your equipment when you get there. And it's not a quick sort of, oh, here you are, use your prescription and use the glasses, whatever. It's not quite like that. So it's a dedicated, fantastic role, but you're a special person who does that. Very, very satisfying. And again, they get all the support from our support people as well. So it's really good. And that linking on to the, I'm sure people will have heard about the work that Specsavers are doing with crisis and homeless people. That's a very big push for us now, knowing that homeless people, because amazing number of them who haven't got an address, can't just walk into an optician's and say, here we are, and I'm going to have my national health test and maybe a free pair of glasses. Well, they can't do that. It doesn't, because they haven't got an address. So we're working towards that being changed. And we also know that vision care for homeless people, I've got lots of centres, and I'm very supportive of that. I think they're marvellous the way they can set that up so that people without an address, basically, they may even be just sofa surfing, as the expression goes, but they can get their eye care, and quite a few of those need to be referred on. It's not always a pair of glasses that they need, but that again is very, very satisfying. And a lot of our staff, our optometrists and optical assistants, will go and help in those centres, and as do lots of optometrists as well. So very much needed. There's so much, it's a growing number. And you shouldn't leave anybody out.
Can we go back to your quote that you can't run retail optics from behind a desk in an office? And throughout this whole conversation, you've shown how out and about you are and how hands-on, and you go and meet people, you go into practices. When we were researching this podcast, I don't know whether it was rumour or true, but I gather you have a series of wigs and you do these sort of in-disguise, incognito practice visits.
At the very beginning, yes, I probably did. When I say at the beginning, say the first 5, 6, 8 years or whatever, people didn't know me. Now, I don't care what wig I would put on or they would know it was me. So now I will go in anyway. And I would, to be frank, I'd always ring up and let them know I was going, because other than that, they're busy. They don't want to suddenly have me stood in front of them. For some reason or other, that frightens them silly.
No, I'm joking. I'd always let somebody know. But in the past, yes, I would do that. And just walk around and try on glasses just to see, to get the feel of what it was like and how, and even speak to other people that were there. So I'd think, once they knew who I, the store would know who I was, I'd be sat there in the waiting area. So, and I would chat to whoever was sat next to. I'm a big chatterbox, as you probably already realised. And I would speak to anyone in a cafe, on a train, in a queue, especially if they're wearing glasses or something, and say, oh, I like your glasses. And then get them on the eyes and, oh, where'd you go? And how do you, this and that? It's always fascinating to find out what people really think without them knowing who I am, because it's just a normal chat. And that's great. I love doing that. Probably too much of that, really, that one day somebody's going to accost me. In fact, I can remember on a railway station when I was waiting for a train talking to an elderly lady, and I sort of started talking to her and she said, do I know you? And I said, no, I don't think so. Well, don't talk to me. So not everybody's open to having a chat. But it's great to know what the patient, what the customer, what they're thinking outside of. You can always do market research, but when, I don't know if you're like me, when you, somebody's doing market research, you almost know what answers they want. You're not totally open and honest. Well, I'm not anyway. And they think, oh, yeah, I know what they're after. So it's nice just to talk to people just generally who don't know who you are and just hear what they've got to say. Yeah.
And Mary, perhaps as we start to think about wrapping things up, you've obviously achieved a huge amount over the past four decades alongside the partners, the Specsavers family. But with benefit of hindsight, is there anything that you would have done differently if you had your time over?
Probably not. I'm sure there's been little hiccups in the way, but I think because I was so focused on the partnership and then we meet up and everything seemed to work out nicely. There's obviously little ups and downs sometimes. Differently was the Netherlands thing. I would never have opened an OptiPrima store, but I'm glad I did because I've got the photograph to just prove that something.
And a nice story to tell.
Maybe right at the beginning, we could have attracted in more on the support side. Like we were a bit late in bringing in a marketing director. Came in. So doing your own marketing. What do optometrists know about marketing? No. But nevertheless, if anybody gets a chance to look at our original logo, so that was designed by moi, my husband. It looks like a Scalix Trix. It's sort of green and orange rings. So it's meant to be like a pair of glasses, but and you know, things. The marketing also a lot of words. So when you look at some of the original stores, and I know what I was trying to do was to have a split fascia. So we had Specsavers on the bottom part, and then a split face of the top part. It would say, for instance, the Bristol one would say M.L. Bevington, ophthalmic optician, first floor. We were trying to separate the eye exam side up from the showroom side. Terribly confusing to people, let's call them customers, terribly confusing to them. So after about the first, what do you think, one, two, about the first, yeah, it was after that first five, maybe number six as well, just Specsavers. They saw adverts with Specsavers and then rock up at a place and then saw M.L. Bevington, ophthalmic optician, and what's all this about? So there's little things like that. Maybe we should have been brave enough and start, but I know what I was trying to do was to separate the clinical side to the retail side, which is almost what we're switching around and going to now. But people are aware, they know it's Specsavers, they know they can trust it, they trust the optometrist and the staff there. So it's not quite the same scenario as going back to 1984, which is a long time ago.
Well, Dame Mary, it's been fascinating speaking with you this afternoon, and thank you for your time and for sharing your story.
Well, I hope it's useful.
Oh, thanks ever so much. It's been fantastic.